All right, we're going to get going. Members and guests, today we're doing two things. First, annually, and Mr. Ernst, you can come forward while we're talking. Annually, the Department of Agriculture gives us a report on the state's ethanol, and particularly the industry, where it's at, payments and monies that are involved, which is obviously critical to this committee. We have a fairly substantial investment out there yet that we're looking at, so we're going to hear that annual report, which is, again, we haven't always heard these reports. We require them, but we don't always hear them, and I think it's when the legislature requires reports, we ought to hear them and understand what's out there. And then after that, we're going to hear from our Office of the Legislative Auditor concerning the County Veteran Service Officers audit report that was here. That's in prelude to tomorrow then, and we'll have the County Veteran Service Officers in tomorrow talking about not only the report, but a lot of what they're seeing for needs out there across the state for veteran services as we look to develop bills this year and next year. So hopefully there's some kind of sequence, and neither day should be too long. So we can get you on your way and get you doing homework somewhere else. So, with that, Mr. Ernst, you're up, and we're looking for an exciting report from you today.
All right, I'll give it my best. Mr. Chairman, I think you all have the report in front of you. It has a seal on it.
And was there extra copies around for people that might want it in the audience? Okay, we have extra copies if anyone wants copies of that report.
Mr. Chairman, Steve Ernest, Financial Management Director at the Department of Agriculture. Just before I get into the report, I'll just remind members that we have $15.168 million in the base each year for our ethanol program. It's a broader appropriation. It's for value added in general, but it's all being used by the ethanol program at this point. This year, we expect to use all that for regular payments. That's payments made during the year. And then as we have plants graduating from the program, we'll in the next 4 years especially, and then a little bit in the year after that, make deficiency payments. Those are the payments we make for the makeup cents per gallon when we paid 13 cents a gallon instead of 20 cents a gallon because we didn't have as much in our budget as we wanted to make the regular payments.
Now, Mr. Ernst, do you have graphs on that? I know in the past the department's prepared that so that we can physically see. You're right. We're locked in about $15 million roughly right now that's going out.
Mm-hmm.
But we've also locked that dollar amount in. So as plants come off, we've got that, I believe, in the base, which then can be utilized for other things, next-gen energy projects or livestock investment grants or other things we see coming. And so here we go. I think it's easier to see when you put a graph up there and kind of try and walk us through that.
So I think you can read that.
Yep.
So in 06, we had $18.1 million in there, but then we dropped that down because it was sufficient to make the regular payments. And you can see the green bars are the regular payments. And they will be for fiscal year 08, 15.123. That's mostly the appropriation. But then next year, we only need 7.3 to make the regular payments. But we'll use the rest of it for the deficiency payments then. We have 13 plants receiving deficiency payments now. Those are plants who are in there basically from 2003, 04, 05, 06, who were paid short on the gallons they produced in those years. One of those 13, for example, is Gopher State, which is out of business, but they're still due their deficiency payments because they're payments on what was already produced back when they were in production. So, as you can see, in 2013, we don't need very much of that at all, only 765. Those are our estimates. We could need a little less if some plants underproduce what we expect them to produce for their regular payments, but we expect to be done with this program in 2013.
Now, is there any monies, is there plants coming off in 11 and 12?
Yes. There will be The statute is very clear that 2010 is the last year we can make regular payments.
Okay.
But in 2010, there's still, it looks like one plant, I don't remember if it's one or two that get a little, that still can get some payments on their regular.
And you just talked about, can you remind the committee what happened to the Gopher State payments when they went out of business in St. Paul?
Well, the bankruptcy court decided who was entitled to the remaining deficiency payments, and those are payments on activity that already happened.
So what are we doing with that now? Who's getting, are we still making payments via the Gopher State contract, and if so, to who?
Yeah, there's a legal entity, and I believe it's called DHLLC. It doesn't have a word name, it just has a letter name. It's the legal entity that the bankruptcy court decided was the heir to the business.
So they're getting annual payments through when?
Because we prorate, all 13 plants will get payments up until the end, unless you change the law to let us pay off some people.
Well, basically, we're not paying, those payments aren't, because I've had this question, even this year. Someone wrote me and said, is it true that we're still making those payments to no ethanol plant? It's just going into the court system, basically, on the bankruptcy. Is that what you're saying?
Well, Mr. Chairman, it goes to a legal business. That's the heir to the business that went bankrupt.
Right.
I think I'm saying that as...
And it's your opinion we can't do anything about that because of the legalities involved, or is there something legislatively we could look at on that? I mean, there's people who think we shouldn't be giving... Number one, there's people who think we shouldn't be giving ethanol payments out, period, but that's another story. But there's certainly people that are amazed that we're handing a payment over to a plant that doesn't exist anymore.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm not an attorney, but I guess my understanding is if we make deficiency payments, we legally have to make them to all 13 plants who are in that situation at that time. Unless you stopped appropriating money for this program, then nobody would get any more money.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we should maybe seek some council opinion on that, because I think you have to look at the overall picture here, and this is the weak link in the chain, and I would prefer we stop payments. And
so maybe between our staff and maybe the AG's office, we could do some review on this, perhaps.
Okay. So, Mr. Chairman, then annually the plants are required to send us their financial statements, and on the first page of the report, the law that requires that is quoted. They have to send them to us by the middle of, we have to report to you by the middle of February. This lists the plants there that are receiving either regular payments or deficiency payments, which are 13 there listed, but as I said, Gopher State isn't a business, an ethanol business anymore, so they don't send a statement. So this report summarizes 12 financial statements.
And again, just to review, no new plants beyond these receive any type of producer payments from us anymore, correct?
Correct.
Right.
So basically what we do is we take all the financial statements and just line them up as best we can. They're all slightly different. And I guess I'd just have you fast forward to page 6 just to kind of see that's what the balance sheets look like, the assets and liabilities, and then page 7 has the income statement, how much they sold and what the cost of sales are, and all that. But then what we did, going back to page 2, is we just tried to give some graphic representations of how the numbers have changed in the last couple years. And I would just remind members, too, this is the fourth report we've done, and if you don't have them handy, we're required to send all the reports we do to the Legislative Reference Library, so they have them all there for the past years. But you can see total assets on that first chart of $673 million. You can see the industry on the assets continues to grow.
And so just to that point again, members and others, as we talk about, again, we see bills come through this place that want to limit growth or discontinue growth of the ethanol business. But, you know, and we hear about Northwest Airlines and other things at times. But look at this, just the ethanol industry alone, almost roughly $675 million of investment out there of assets on the ground for this industry. And that's huge in rural Minnesota. That, you know, 15 years ago, this wasn't there. So I think that's worth noting.
And Mr. Chairman, I'd remind everyone that this is 12 plants, and I think there are 17 in the state now.
Yep.
So it's not even the whole industry represented here, the state in the state. On page 3, then, we have the sales and gross profit. Again, we have an increase. I think it's healthy for these businesses. And
again, just a note, as we look at the bottom line, 07, $203 million of net income. Most of these plants are cooperatively owned by our farmer producers or the communities. So this is money that now is circulating throughout our rural communities. And again, I think that's important to note, as opposed to some of the other models now where they're maybe corporate owned or this is money that... 5 to 7 times, depending on what you adhere to, is turning over in our communities. And again, something that wasn't there 15 years ago is there now, and that's a big difference in rural Minnesota. Do I sound like a cheerleader for ethanol, Peter?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, then the final part of the report, we summarized some of the statistical numbers or the key numbers. First, actually, we mentioned what the... some of the government assistances that the plants have received, it's gone down, and that's because plants are coming off our program, $15.5 million this year, and of course these statements don't exactly equal our fiscal year for the appropriations. And then there's some federal money in there too that's described on page 4, the top of page 4.
How many years have you been doing these reports?
The fourth.
Fourth, okay. I mean, it would have been interesting to see the profitability in those first years out there when this industry started, which, again, is the other thing that we talk about. People ask, well, why are we still doing this? Well, number one, we made a commitment to do it, and I think it's important we follow through on our commitments. But number two, if we go back to the early years of these plants, a lot of them weren't showing pluses in the profitability line at the end of the page. So I think we need to keep that in mind. It's too bad we didn't do these reports back then. It'd be pretty interesting to track.
Then on the ownership section, I think the best way to look at that would be to go to page 11, the last page where I have it graphically. And the key... or one of the important ways we look at this is whether it meets the definition in statute, Minnesota Statute 500.24. That defines what a farmer is, what a family farm is, and those are legal definitions where we've made some attempts over the years to get the information from the plants as to who in the co-op, for example, is a farmer or isn't a farmer. And what we do now in the last few years is we ask them to report if that ownership has changed by 10% or more. So these aren't exact numbers, but it's a fair representation, and we still have over half meeting the definition, and that's just a legal definition. That's not maybe on the ground what you or I would call a farmer necessarily.
Okay.
The other part of the report page 9 is the statistics that summarizes some of the numbers from the balance sheet and the income statement, the revenue, sales, operating income, and taxes and payments. And then on the bottom, it does some financial analysis. These ratios are, you know, specific to different industries, and I couldn't tell you, you know, benchmarks per se on these numbers. What I can say is, you know, the liquidity and leverage assets or measures are especially looked at by lenders. They see current ratios of assets divided by the liabilities. You know, if you had to sell off, would it cover it? And the quick ratio, it just takes out the inventory because that's not as easy to get rid of quickly. The leverage is basically how much you're in debt. Debt to your assets, debt to your equity. These are things lenders would look at. The activity and profitability, those are more measures that managers would look at. How fast your inventory turns over, kind of similar to, how fast your inventory turns over. A high profit industry would turn over the inventory slower. A real low margin would have to turn it over a lot faster. So different industries have different keys as to what that would be. And I'm not an expert on the industry-wide measures, but and then profitability, return, margin on sales, and those kind of things.
So overall, when you look at this sheet, how would you categorize the health of our ethanol plant and industry out there?
Well, I think the industry is healthy, and I think that our program has helped them, and we're happy that it's been successful.
Mm-hmm. Any questions, members, on the report or to the department? All right, seeing none. We appreciate you coming in. It's important we see this every year and keep track of that industry, and we will go from there. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, CVSOs and the auditor. Here she comes. And we like visual aids, so we're glad you brought that.
Well, it's not very fancy.
I would remind people, too, in the audience, we have coffee up here. If anyone wants, help yourself. This is the Ag Committee, and a cup of coffee is very appropriate. So, when you're ready, you introduce yourself and proceed.
I'm ready. Good morning. My name is Jill Boss, and I'm with the Legislative Auditor's Office, and I'm here this morning to summarize our evaluation of county veteran service officers. Now, it was about a year ago that the Legislative Audit Commission told us to take a look at this topic. At that time, legislators were concerned about the quality and the quantity of services provided by different service by the county officers. And there's also some concern about public accountability. So what we did is we went out and we looked at service office staffing, spending, activities, oversight, and outcomes. And our overall conclusion is that, yes, there are some problems, but that major structural changes in how the system is set up are not necessary. We think that veteran service offices should remain a county function, but we also think that state supervision needs to be strengthened. Let me backtrack just a bit and give you a little bit of background information on why we have service offices to begin with. The federal government estimates that there are about 402,000 veterans in Minnesota, at least in 2007. And this is about 8% of the state's population. Now, being a veteran might make you eligible for a broad array of federal and state programs, including things like disability compensation, pensions, health services, and emergency financial assistance. But getting those benefits is not always easy. First of all, there are just a lot of programs out there, and the eligibility criteria vary by program. Whether or not a veteran qualifies for a specific program can depend on factors such as where they serve, when they served, whether they sustained any service-connected injuries. And program eligibility can and does change over time, both because because Congress or the legislature changes program requirements, or because the condition of a veteran might change. So it's kind of a fluid situation. And we're talking about a pretty sizable chunk of money that comes into the state's veterans. Federal benefits for Minnesota veterans came to about $1.1 billion in 2005, and it was just slightly more than this in 2006. State benefits through the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs adds about another $1 million or so to the pot each year. Now, the two largest categories of benefits are medical services and disability compensation and pensions. And together, these two categories account for more than 90% of the federal dollars coming to the state's veterans. Now, county veteran service officers have been around since 1945. Their main job is to help veterans access the benefits that they've earned. And they do this by acting as sort of an independent go-between between the veterans and government, whether it's state government or federal government, generally the federal government. Service officers are county employees. State law requires that each county board appoint a county veteran service officer and then give that officer the necessary staff, supplies, office space, whatever they need to do the job. At the same time, though, state law gives the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs general supervisory authority over the officer's activities. So we kind of have a dual responsibility there. One of the first things that we looked at in our study was service office staffing. And like I said, this is a decision that counties make, how many staff to hire, what to pay their staff, things like that. First off, we found that every county does have a county veteran service officer. But many service officers are only part-time employees. And a sizable number of officers also have other job-related other job responsibilities, such as most often something like emergency management director. About a third of the officers do not have any support staff to answer telephones, to greet veterans when they come in the office, or just to help with paperwork. Another third have part-time support staff, and then the last third have at least one support staff to help just process out the paper. Now, to put these staffing numbers in perspective, we looked at how the number of veterans in a county compares with the number of staff in their service office. And we called this the veterans to staff ratio. And we found that these ratios range from 350 veterans per staff to over 11,000 veterans. Perhaps not surprising, we found that the rural counties, which tend to have fewer veterans and I guess fewer people in general, tended to have lower veterans to staff ratios than did the large metropolitan area counties. And we found basically the same pattern for expenditures by the officers. Median spending by county veteran service officers in 2006 was about $106,000. But this ranged anywhere from $11,000 to over $600,000. On a per veteran basis, then, spending ranged from about $5 per veteran at the low end and up to about $125 per veteran at the high end. And again, service offices that tended to spend more per veteran tended to be the small rural counties. We also looked at the kinds of activities that service offices engaged in. And one of the first things we found is that even though the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs is charged with supervising the office's activities, there are no statewide data on what these offices do. So we surveyed all of the offices in the state, and we also went out and visited with 17 offices statewide. Now, service offices basically do three types of activities. They do outreach to let veterans know about the available benefits. They answer questions and things when veterans come into the office. And then third, they help veterans actually file the claim. And they try to do all these things through a wide variety of activities. There's kind of a common core of activities that almost all veteran service officers engage in. Almost all of them make presentations to local veterans organizations. They talk to community groups. They do hospital visits, home visits, funeral home visits. Many of them write newspaper columns or at least periodically put kind of like public service announcements in the newspaper. But one of the things that we found in our site visits was that each office also tries to tailor their activities to what they feel are their unique local needs. And this can range anything from, in one county, we talked with a service officer who, during the holiday season, puts together food baskets for veterans that are in need. Another service officer said that, well, she routinely likes to just drop in on a couple of the veterans in her community because they're elderly or at risk and with no family, just likes to drop in occasionally and just see how they're doing, see if they need anything. At the other extreme, we have counties that are instrumental in organizing massive events called stand-downs, where they bring in hundreds of veterans and numerous service providers to try to deal with those counties' problems and those veterans' problems all in one big event. And so activities can get very individualized in terms of what the county needs. And this is a good thing. This is one of the advantages of having a county-based system. But activities like this are difficult to measure. Service offices vary substantially in the amount and type of data that they collect and how they collect it. And this includes some very basic data on something like the number of veterans claims that each office files. They all differ on whether or not they collect that kind of information. We also found that there is no statewide measure of veteran satisfaction. And this has to do a lot with federal regulations. Nobody knows who all the veterans are. And many of the county veteran service officers don't know who all the veterans are in their own communities. Some of the county offices do conduct customer satisfaction surveys where they try to gauge the satisfaction of the veterans who come into their offices. But most of the officers told us that they generally measure satisfaction more anecdotally, by the reaction they get on the street, by having Bill Jones come in and say, my neighbor Fred told me that you helped him, so what can you do for me? Now, overall, we thought that the service officers were doing a good job and engaged in a lot of activities, but that doesn't mean that there aren't some isolated problems out there. We know from our interviews with department staff, with some of the related service organizations, and as even with other county veteran service officers, that some offices have had problems, especially in the past, just serving the veterans that they have. And as a result, neighboring county offices have often have at times had to pick up the slack. But because there are no statewide data, no consistent data on what these offices do, it's difficult to identify in any systematic fashion where the problems are, or to catch them early and sort of, I guess, nip them in the bud, so to say. We did survey all of the county administrators around the state to find out what they thought of their county veteran service office. And for the most part, they're pleased with the way these offices are performing and the amount of feedback they get from the offices. Since the main job of the service office is to make sure that veterans have access to benefits. We looked at how many veterans in each county received benefits and how much they got. Now, no one knows how many veterans are actually eligible for benefits. But we do know that about 12% of the state's veterans received compensation or pension benefits in 2005. This number varies by county, and it ranged anywhere from 9% in one county up to 21% in another. The average benefit received in 2005 was about $10,000 a year. But this also varied widely, and it ranged from slightly more than $6,200 to nearly three times that amount. Same picture, I guess, for medical benefits. Again, no one knows how many veterans are actually eligible for services, but we do know that a little bit more than a fifth of the state's veterans actually received health services in 2005. Again, this range, though, anywhere from around 7% to 50% of the county's veterans might have received benefits. On average, when they received benefits, they got about $6,100 worth of benefits from the federal government. And again, this range anywhere from $3,000 to $10,000. Now, we looked for some explanation as to why there are county differences, and we asked, well, is it something that the County Veterans Service Office is doing, or is it something related more to something that's totally outside the county's control? And the answer is, it's a little bit of both. For example, we found that counties that had better staff service officers relative to their veteran population, and by better, I mean counties with lower veteran to staff ratios, these counties tended to have higher percentages of veterans receiving benefits than did counties with higher veteran to staff ratios. But we also found that demographic factors that are largely outside of a county's control also affect participation rates. For example, counties with high proportions of older veterans tend to have higher proportions of veterans receiving services. So did counties with lower average personal income. The lower the average personal income of a county, the more it seemed like a veteran's, higher proportion of veterans received benefits. Likewise, counties that are not densely populated, that is, counties with few veterans per square mile, these counties tended to have higher proportions of veterans receiving benefits. Another legislative concern that we looked at was supervision. We looked at how the state actually supervises the county veteran service officers. And we found that even though the department is required by law to oversee the officers, state law gives the department very few tools to actually use to oversee them. There are no reporting requirements or mechanisms. State law does not require the Department of Veterans Affairs to collect any statewide information from on service office activities, nor does state law require that service officers routinely file reports with the state or even routinely file reports with their own county board. Consequently, the department doesn't collect any statewide information, and counties vary substantially in what they collect, how they collect it, and the definitions that they use when they do collect it. Likewise, there are no statewide goals or expectations for service officers. Now, part of the supervisory problem has to do with the fact that the Department of Veterans Affairs has very little clout over service officers. Statutes do not require that counties consult with the Department of Veterans Affairs when they hire or reappoint their service officer every few years, even though the state is responsible for supervising their activities. Although the state has a certification program for service officers that requires them to take an annual exam and to take part in a certain amount of training every year, service officers only have to be certified if they want to obtain an operational grant from the state. And these grants are small and only available to its county once every 3 years. And on a per-year basis, most counties average less than $1,000 per year in state funding. So where does that leave us? Well, we, in our report, we make a number of suggestions, mostly designed to provide the state with more tools to actually oversee the officers. Our first recommendation is to better define the department's roles and statutes. And in this respect, we think the department should consult with the Association of Minnesota Counties and the Minnesota Association of County Veteran Service Officers and come up with some agreed-upon language. We also think that the legislature should require counties to consult with the department when hiring or reappointing their service officers. We don't think the department should have the final say about who's hired or that the department should, you know, say hire that person or don't hire that person. This should remain a county responsibility. But we do think that counties should ask for the state's input. Some counties currently do this, and the department takes part in selection panels and advises counties about what the position descriptions involve. But for every county that asks for the department's help, there's another county that doesn't. We also think that the legislature should require that service officers be certified by the state. Now, currently, every service officer is certified. But the state walks kind of a fine line between what it can require a service officer and what service officers may be able or willing to do. For the most part, there are few consequences for not complying with department requests for information. We also think that service officers should be required to collect and report key performance information to the department. For example, information on the number of claims that they filed on behalf of veterans in a year. Without consistent statewide information, the department is not able to adequately supervise the officers. And we think that the department should come up with a few key measures after consulting with the Association of Minnesota Counties and the Minnesota Association of County Veteran Service Officers. We also think that the department could include performance information in its annual report to the legislature, and it should routinely send this performance information to county boards so that county boards would be better able to oversee their individual officers. Finally, we think that there needs to be a statewide management information system so that the county officers are able to collect and provide consistent information. Now, the Department of Veterans Affairs is currently implementing a very user-friendly management information system at the state level, and a number of service officers are also adopting that same system. We think that it should be more uniform, that everybody should be on the same system. And we think the department should seek the necessary funding from the legislature in order to accomplish that. And that is sort of the report in a nutshell. We have a number of other recommendations that are listed on page 57 in the report. But otherwise, I'd be happy to answer any questions or comments or...
All right. Well, thank you very much. There are copies, I believe, of the report over there for people that want them, too, or we can get them to you if there's not enough. I see the commissioner sitting here. Welcome. Tomorrow, we're trying to get the counties to come in, too. We haven't gotten contacted, but we'd sure like to hear from them, as well as the county veteran service officers tomorrow on some of these things. And again, the reason this report is here is not to criticize, but to understand how we can move forward in a very positive way with our systems. I'd also like research staff, to provide us tomorrow with the statutory guidelines. What does it say in statutes? If you can make copies of those actual statutes and have them in our packets tomorrow so we can see what we have put in place already as a legislative body into law, as far as oversight on these things go, that would be helpful. And certainly, I guess I'd leave it up to you, Commissioner, if you want to say something now, or if you tomorrow, we'd give you an opportunity to maybe, even though we don't have your bill here yet, we know there's things coming that are kind of pertaining to this, and it'd be a good time to start that conversation with this group too. So if you're around tomorrow, we'd invite you to do that, bring some prepared materials perhaps, and talk about what you're seeing and what your recommendations might be from your department. We want to hear from the counties on what they think the partnership should be and where they're coming from, and then most importantly, we want to hear from the county veteran service officers on not only the report, but what they'd like for tools and help in the future too. So, questions, members, on anything you've heard today so far? You did a really good job, and we do appreciate it. I think there are some holes that need to be filled. Again, I think the goal is of everyone in the room to deliver services to veterans across the state in a positive and meaningful way, and we are disjointed. And I think all of us, if you've paid attention in the past to your counties, will know that. And I'll use my own county as an example. For years, we had a county veteran service office and officer that people ended up not using. They drove to Renville County rather than go to Candy Lake County just because they understood the level of service and attention and everything else was better. We got a new county veteran service officer a year ago or so, and we saw the activity in that office switch. It grew. We saw federal benefits coming into the county because of the service officer. They were able to get more grants and more money coming, and we just saw a whole different level of activity. So we know there's a difference in service officers. That's not to blame the service officers, but rather how can we help them with best practices and let them know what the other counties are doing, and you know, share some of this stuff. There shouldn't be secrets out there. This is a committee of no secrets, we always talk about, and we need to do that with veterans too. So that's where we're at. Any questions, members? All right, tomorrow will be Representative Heigerken, who does have his name tag and still is on this committee, and more than welcome.
It disappeared for a while, didn't it?
It did. Well, the staff took away all his stuff. I don't know why, but
it's just a
comment. Yesterday, you're back.
Yes, just a comment in regards to, I know that there are commodity groups sitting out over here, and I want to thank those folks. We had a very tough vote yesterday in transportation that affects our gravel roads and our way of getting produce to the markets. And I want to thank the corn growers and the sugar beet and soybean, Farmers Union, the NFL, Farm Bureau, Republican wing of our group, to really stand up. The township officials for doing battle. We're going to get money for our gravel roads. The chamber, the Minnesota Truckers Association. And I want to call, and I want to thank, I did not get one negative comment from any superintendent, a lot of phone calls, thanking you for the rural superintendents, school board members, county commissioners, again, but I want to thank all the farm commodity groups for getting into the battle, because it was very important, and I don't think we'll ever see today. The foe again was the Taxpayers League, and you know very well the next bill that we would have saw would have been a Taxpayers League bill. But so I think we got a good bill going for us, but I want to thank the farm commodity groups for backing me up. Thank you.
Thank you for that, and I will amplify that too, even though this isn't a transportation hearing. We obviously passed the bill, but Representative Heigerken, I think the rural commodity groups, farm groups, and others understood better than anyone the need. They're out on those roads. They can't use some of the bridges. They need shoulders to get their big equipment down. They need to move their product from farm to market, even down here in the Twin Cities. They got it a long time ago, so we do appreciate the support that the rural ag community showed to that bill. So, any other questions to the auditor or to the transportation bill? All right, seeing none, we'll get you out of here early today, and members, tomorrow will be the response and information day. Meeting's adjourned.